Good morning, folks. It's supposed to be a hot one today and again tomorrow. So if you're out and about, just make sure that you are properly hydrated. A heat index like no other that we've had this winter. So just keep that in mind. We've got a great show coming up today. Guy Williams, President Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, joins us as he always does Monday at noon. We'll talk about what is a stable coin, what you don't why you don't want one, the Louisiana DMV scam returns, and how the government protected and regulated the U.S. car industry into global irrelevance. We'll also talk about tariffs. There was an self-imposed August 1st deadline by President Donald Trump. Seems as though they've been able to work out tariffs deals with a number of countries, a number still to come. They say we'll talk about the impact of same. Jay LaPere joins us in the 11 o'clock hour, CEO of Latrum. He's also the board chair of the Cato Institute and the Atlas Society. And they've set out on a mission of the Free Society Coalition to bring people together across backgrounds and beliefs. And they believe a deeper understanding of the principles and of the extraordinary, though imperfect, achievements of the American founding will reinforce the cultural importance of civil discourse, independent thinking, and respect for the dignity of each individual. And this as we approach our 250th birthday next year. So we'll visit with Jay LaPere. At 10:30, Harry Nelson, he's a founder and managing partner at Nelson Hardiman. He spends a lot of time studying healthcare. He actually wrote a book about the state of the United States of opioids, is what it's called, a prescription for liberating a nation in pain. But more importantly, we're going to talk to him about Medicaid. This has been bantered about as it relates to new rules in the big, beautiful bill. Recently, the CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, found up to 2.8 million Americans were actually enrolled in two separate government health plans, both underwritten by the taxpayers. It would seem to me, we have all these data centers and stuff, you know, we wonder why we can't figure out and align this, and why it takes so long to figure out that we have people double dipping across this country, and it continues to be a problem. There's a lot of consternation and criticism about the big, beautiful bill relative to checking and auditing enrollment and the rolls twice a year as opposed to once. Well, this is some of the reasons why. It seems as though we're not doing a good job. We'll find out from Harry just how bad it truly is. Speaking of bad, just when you thought it couldn't get worse, first it started with 10 inmates at large. That was whittled down to one. Now we're at two. And this continues to repeat itself with the failures of the Orleans Parish Sheriff's Office, and in particular, Sheriff Susan Hudson, who's getting all too comfortable with going to the mic and saying, "This is on me. We got it now. We Sheriff, we understand that all of these mistakes are on you." Quite frankly, we've understood that from the very beginning. We said from the very beginning that this was going to be a disaster, and it turned out to be exactly that. It's not that we had this magical crystal ball. We just understood the level of incompetence, inefficiency, and otherwise from your previous positions leading up into this, coupled with some of your progressive ideas that we knew was going to be not a good thing for the taxpayer, public, of the city of New Orleans. And it turned out to be true. And yet, I think I still may be the lone voice saying, even though we're this close to an upcoming election, you need to resign. Get out of there. We don't want to hear you going to the mic again to remind us that this is on you. We're not stupid. We got it. We know it's on you. And that's why you're not going to get reelected. And instead of just creating more noise as we go through this election season, just get out. Get out. Do us all a favor. Save us with "this one's on me." And then, you know, talk about accountability and then try to write this off as a clerical error. You do realize, Sheriff, that most of what goes on inside a jail is all about documentation. From the booking process to classification of the inmates, assignment to the inmates in a specific geographic location within the facility, documenting whether or not they're getting their appropriate meds, documenting whether or not they're getting fed, documenting whether or not they're getting recreation, documenting whether or not they're getting to their doctor's appointments, this, that, or everything else. It's all, for the most part, clerical. That's what you do. And a lot of it is all about CYA. Cover your ass, plain and simple. Because you know that at some point in time, you're going to get sued. And you try to create a documentation stream to prove otherwise, that you and the men and women of your organization have done the right thing, have fulfilled all of the obligations they have, whether or not they're constitutional or otherwise. And in your case, while under the oversight of the federal government, you need to be able to convince the federal monitors that you're actually dotting the I's and crossing the T's. So let me remind you again, it's all clerical. And I don't know about you folks, but have you had enough? Have you had enough about, well, you know, relative to this? I have. So let's talk about this clerical thing for a moment. Yes, there can be mistakes. Human intervention is not perfect. No human system that requires the product of human intervention is going to be perfect. So what do? You set up redundancy, right? You set up internal controls to try and minimize whatever risk there is relative to a sole human intervention, one person, maybe having a bad day, maybe got a headache, maybe has a toothache, maybe has any number of things where they're not on their attention game. They're not dotting the I's, they're not crossing the T's. So in order to minimize the risk imposed on society at large, and let me remind you what that is, Sheriff, in case you don't recall, because it's getting very comfortable for you to say that this is on you, it's violent inmates being released who should otherwise be in jail. Got it? It's simple. So there's a redundant system that's set up so that you're not relying on one, that you have actually someone checking the other person's work, and you are comparing the paperwork that you have to the ban that you have on these inmates, right? You have them kind of artificially tattooed by having identification bans and other ways of documenting, you know, whether or not that's the right person by looking at height, weight, you know, race, gender, hair, tattoos. There's all kinds of different ways to make sure you have the right person doing it. But that person having the bad day, if that's the only person that's looking at it, and they miss all of these identifying characteristics, and they let this individual out, it's not good enough for you to go to the mic and say, "This is on me." The truth be told, it's not on you. It's on the community at large. And let me state the obvious for you in case you've missed this too, which would not surprise me. They are more at risk. I'll say it again. It's on the community, not you. They are more at risk. And when you add to this equation all of the work that was done by the arresting agency, more likely than not the NOPD or the state police, risking their lives to put their hands around an individual in order to incapacitate that individual, for what purpose? To make the community safer. How do they feel this morning when they realize the risks that they took came down to a clerical error? To diminish all of that and put the public, the community at large, at risk yet again. So without these internal controls in place and adhered to day in and day out and checked, internal audits being done inside the organization to make sure that the internal control system is sacrosanct, unless and until that's done, it's on the community. They're at risk. That's why you are compelled to go. And what makes it even worse is that this comes in the aftermath of 10 inmates embarrassing not only you, but your organization, the city of New Orleans, and a taxpaying public. Not national news, international news. Your office has become a joke. You are the face of the joke. So again, it's not on you. It's on our community at large. We have people trying to decide whether or not New Orleans is a place that they desire to live. It seems as though we're doing a great job reducing crime, locking up the impact criminals and the like. But we can't keep them in what is supposed to be a facility that's all about confinement. There's a huge breakdown. And when we think about the millions upon millions of dollars spent in building buildings, putting up bars, controlling keys, controlling computer programs, in an attempt to keep the worst of the worst off the streets of this city, to keep them in a confined facility appropriately, according to law, it seems as though we can't get it done. So again, as a reminder, it's not on you. It's on the community at large. So do them a favor. Resign. Leave. Hasta la vista. You're gone. It's easy. Credible leaders know when it's time. Not to suggest that you were ever a credible leader, but there is still time. Look yourself in the mirror critically and be honest for the first time with the voting public of this city and resign. We'll be right back. Folks, you will recall we've talked about this once before, that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services reported a couple of weeks ago that 1.2 million Americans were enrolled in Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program in two or more states. CMS worked with software engineers to review enrollment data, and while doing so, they found another 1.6 million enrolled in both Medicaid and an Obamacare plan with taxpayer subsidies in 2024. One would think, with all of the automation that goes on today, that we would be able to reconcile this in a much better fashion. You will recall that in the Big Beautiful Bill, one of the provisions there is that we audit the enrollment data and audit those that are on the program twice a year now in order to ensure that they are still eligible. And there's been huge pushback on this issue. Joining us is Harry Nelson. He is the author of The United States of Opioids, a presentation for liberating a nation in pain. But he's more importantly a founder and managing partner at Nelson Hardiman Law Firm, and he is an expert in healthcare law. Harry, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be with you guys.
So, Harry, at first blush, when we read this, we wonder, you know, if we subscribe for just about anything on the internet, you know, right away they'll send us a prompt. Well, you already have an account. Can we ever get to achieve that here with CMS and the management of both Medicare, Medicaid, CHIP, and the Obamacare plan?
You're asking a great question. You know, you wonder when you see how the rest of the business world works, how your credit card companies detect any kind of questionable thing. You wonder why government health programs don't. At the moment, unfortunately, it's very sort of carved up into a lot of separate states, separate Medicaid managed care plans. You have the Obamacare exchange plans, and the right hand is not talking to the left hand. So no one's getting those signals, and you end up in the situation we are, where people are signed up and getting benefits in multiple places.
So, but why is that? I mean, obviously, this can't be the first time they discovered this double dipping phenomenon, right?
There's a couple. Yeah, it's been happening for a long time. The more that we've seen Medicaid grow in the last 15 years since Obamacare, we've seen this problem get worse because now we have all these Medicaid managed care plans, which didn't exist 20 years ago. And so a lot of private separate companies working. But I think we have to distinguish between two kinds of double dipping. There's one where people just, you know, people might move from one place to another and they don't even realize that they're basically necessarily participating, or they're not trying to pull one over. And then we have a whole part of this where people are actually are committing active fraud and getting both patients and providers are benefiting by billing twice for the same services. So it's so there's two different things going on here. One is kind of what I would call an administrative sloppiness that we would benefit from tightening up in the way you're suggesting, where you get pinged, hey, you already got an account. And the other is a much more kind of disturbing pattern.
Obviously, both the administrative failure side of that is, as opposed to the intentional side of it, all have a negative impact on the programs. They all cost money. You have to go back and reconcile all of these records and the like. So there's not anything positive of either happenstance, right?
Absolutely not. No, a lot of times it's just, you know, it's the way that our system sort of built up. We didn't do it from a centralized place. That's the big difference you see, by the way, between Medicare, which is centrally organized out of the federal government, and Medicaid, which is happening state by state. And so you end up with people who become eligible for one program, and they might be eligible for Medicaid and sign up for Medicaid, and then they get a job, and now they are eligible for an Affordable Care Act, Obamacare exchange plan, and they forget that they needed to disenroll from the other from the first plan. And so the taxpayers are paying essentially for both. It's a system that we're that needs much, much more coordination and infrastructure because it's so balkanized, it's so carved up.
Yeah, CMS preliminary estimates is that this is costing as much as $14 billion a year, so it's a huge number. I've heard about your book, Harry, and I think there are a lot of I'm wondering in your mind if there's some similarities as it relates to this inability for the left hand to know what the right hand is doing and vice versa. It seems as though there was a breakdown in the administration of opioids across this country, and information back breakdown and information sharing breakdown. Do you see some similarities?
Yeah, look, I do. I think in many ways what we're seeing is really like a tug of war and a lack of a national consensus that's leading to us getting pulled in opposite directions and preventing us from coming up with practical solutions. And I think there very much are parallels to the same fight we were having 15 years ago when I wrote when I was writing the book. We gotta get to a place where we start focusing on, say, you know, efficiently coming up with a system that costs as little as possible and provides the best possible coordination of care. Because instead, what we have is we have a system get built up and pulled apart, and you end up with this level of disorganization, miscommunication, and we don't benefit from it. There's just so much waste. I personally believe that $14 billion number is probably accurate, if anything, an understatement. So I think it is the same problem playing out again, and I think it will continue to play out until we really manage to come to a consensus and build a system that has some centralization in it.
Why is there just a reluctance, or does this just get lost in the weeds because these systems are so large now that we have a struggle day by day just keeping these things afloat and processing these claims and moving the dollars around?
I think the people who are developing these programs are doing their best, but I think at the very point of inception, I think it's very important to remember. And you got to go back to the mid-1960s for this. You know, when we created Medicare, we had a national consensus at the beginning that we want to provide care for America's elderly, and we did it in one fell swoop. When it came to providing care originally for, right, Medicaid was an income-based program. For America's poor, it was very controversial. There were all the same questions that are coming up today. Are people not working because they're getting entitlements? We had questions. It was in the middle of the civil rights era, and southern states were very suspicious that it was being used for this northern agenda of integration. And so as a result, the solution was, we're just going to kick it to every state, and we're going to let every state do its own thing. And literally from that point forward, for the last 60 years, we've had accusations coming out of Washington, D.C., that the states are doing a terrible job. And some states are doing better jobs, and some states are doing worse jobs. But then what you have to add on top of that now is we've now given managed care companies a role on top of the states. So we literally have not 50 different systems. We have, like, you know, depending on what state you're in, like 500 different systems. We have one system in Medicare, and we have 500 in Medicaid as a result of what I'm describing. And I think no matter how well-intentioned people are, it was bound to result in this kind of disarray.
And over and above that, the menu in each state of items, you know, just to kind of put this in simple language, is entirely different, right?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. It's crazy, right? If you're out here in California, you know, you have a very rich benefit with all kinds of inclusive things. If you're living in some of the southeastern states down in Mississippi, Alabama, you're going to find a much narrower program, and every flavor in between. And it's not predictable. So that also adds a layer of complexity to it of trying to figure out as the states are navigating. It's going to be interesting to watch these next couple of years with the cuts that are coming from the One Big Beautiful Bill to see how the states are going to respond. You're going to see even more variation as every state tries to wrestle with its own financial challenge and deciding how much to cover, who to cover, there's going to have to be some hard decisions made. They're going to look very different from place to place.
I know you're involved in conversations about this all the time. People that I talk to are really shocked when they hear the income disparity to qualify for Medicaid programs from state to state. Most people assume that it's the same, and that's not true, is it?
Yeah, no, originally it was supposed to be set at the federal poverty level, you know, but what we learned over the years was we had, at one point, going back, if you go back to the early 90s, you had something like 40 million uninsured Americans. And so part of the solution of how we covered those people was by extending out the far above federal poverty limit. It was originally to 136%, 137%, and then then in some states up to multiple percentages of that federal poverty level. So you have, you know, you've had very philosophically different approaches. Part of it was also that on top, you know, for people who were let's say the working poor, the working class, who had jobs that didn't give them insurance. So this would be people working in restaurants and in car washes and all these places that just didn't provide benefits that America's middle class, that white collar jobs provided. We created this whole Obamacare exchange system, but that didn't work. That hasn't worked particularly well either. So what happened is a lot of the states said, if the exchanges aren't going to be solving the problem and people can't really afford health care, even if we put them on these policies, we might as well expand Medicaid further. So you've had states go in totally different directions. Some states taking a very tight, you know, we only want to cover the people who are truly, truly the poorest. And some states saying, no, we've got to broaden the benefit. California, almost 40% of the population is now eligible or on Medicaid, just a little bit under 39%. So, you know, that's an example of a state that took a very expansive vision of Medicaid as the solution. And then you have states. The percentages are a fraction because they're only covering people who are disabled or you know, women and children and very close to the poverty line.
And California, correct me if I'm wrong, has one of the highest income eligibility provisions as well.
That's part of the point. Is that California has had a specific policy of saying Medicaid works. It actually is much harder. You know, the challenge when you put people on the Obamacare exchanges was they still had to pay. They had to pay out of pocket, and people weren't using their insurance, or they would lose their insurance. And so California made Medicaid easier and easier to sign up for, including on an income level, because the whole point was, Medicaid is solving an important part of the problem, that we have some part of our population gets their insurance, their health coverage at work. Part of it, seniors and people on Social Security disability get their insurance through Medicare. But everybody else who can't do it on an income basis, Medicaid is the best solution we've got. And of course, for the people who are elderly and at the nearer to poverty, we have the dual status where you can be Medicare, Medicaid, Medi-Medi. So Medicaid. So California deliberately raised the income thresholds in order to cover more people because Medicaid has been seen as working. In other parts of the country, Medicaid has been seen as the problem, keeping people motivated not to work. But California very much has made a decision that this is what we as a state want to do, because it's actually getting people access to doctors preventatively before they get to the emergency room. It's getting them access to mental health and substance, you know, addiction treatment and everything else that people need. So it's a philosophical choice we've made as a state.
Harry, we're speaking with Harry Nelson, founder and managing partner at Nelson Hardiman Law Firm. He's an expert in healthcare. Harry, because you know so much about, and I don't mean to pick on California, but I think because you know so much about that system there, I think there's really value in talking about it. This becomes a budgetary thing, right? Because at one point in time, the state shared 50-50 with the federal government the cost of Medicaid. And when they came in with the Obamacare and these subsidies and then Medicaid expansion, this changed. In fact, the federal government is now financing about 90% of that cost. How much of an influence, and did this really create a landscape for more bastardization of this misalignment that's going on?
Yeah, this is an interesting question. So, by the way, just for the people who have the numbers, California's budget this past year includes $161 billion for Medicaid. About two-thirds comes from Washington. But what you're talking about, part of what President Obama and Congress did back in 2010 when they passed the Affordable Care Act was they said to the states, we want you to expand Medicaid and make Medicaid more available to everybody who can't afford to buy their own insurance. And in return, we're going to give you much more money. We're going to get out of this historic pattern of a 50-50 roughly matching, and we're going to cover 90% of the cost of the expansion of this new population because we want more people on Medicaid. And the question, the Republican response at that point was, eventually, we know Washington D.C. isn't going to pay the bill forever. And that's going to be taken away. And what are the states going to do then? And that was a complaint that the funding for Medicaid was very generous from the federal government up front, but was going to ultimately land on the doorstep of taxpayers in the states down the road. So it's a really tricky thing. I think that when we talk about double dipping and issues like that, we're talking about failures. But I do think if you're going to take a fair objective approach, there have been a lot of successes, and there are a lot of people out there who are doing better today in terms of access to healthcare coverage because of that expansion.
No doubt.
But we're in a tough. It's a tough. These are real financial, decisions that I think are tricky. And I appreciate the chance to talk about them because I think we don't think about them enough, and we don't put enough pressure on our system to work more efficiently and to improve the quality of care.
Yeah, no doubt. In fact, you don't know this about me, but I'm a Republican. I was one of the few that supported Medicaid expansion in Louisiana because we are a very poor state. But all the while warned everyone, there's going to be a day of reckoning. And I don't know when it's going to be, but what I do know is that math has no emotion. And when you're dealing with state budgets that are shrinking and, tax base that's shrinking, these are pretty good indicators that the day of reckoning is coming sooner than what others may have thought. And in many states, I think you know this to be true. There's already a day of reckoning, and that's why we find ourselves in the position we do today. Harry Nelson, thank you so much for joining us, author of The United States of Opioids, A Prescription for Liberating a Nation in Pain. Truly appreciate your time and your insight. Have a great week.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. On a text line, it says, Newell, when John Bel Edwards was in as governor, you were all in on Medicaid. You were saying how great it was for the hospitals and for people so they wouldn't go to them, the emergency room, and now all of a sudden you totally change your tune. What happened? Is it because Jeff Landry is now governor and he's against Medicaid? No, I just explained what this was all about. It didn't make sense for us not to expand Medicaid when all other states, Republican-led states as well, were expanding Medicaid. We would have been leaving federal dollars on the table. But I also said, remember that there will be a day of reckoning. And this is an opportunity to get into our system, improve the system, improve the quality of it, the administration of it, to gain a better understanding of who's in and who's out on this system. There's no doubt that there's a need. It's a question of whether or not we as a state can afford to be all things to all people. I would suggest that we cannot. And that's why I've spent this time with experts, more of an education for folks to understand the financing of Medicaid, where it came from, how did we get to where we are today, and whether or not there's going to be the continued appetite in Washington facing a $36 trillion debt, where we're continuing to borrow money to pay for these subsidies that are out there. And both Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, they're the biggest. And they all have a date looming out there where it becomes a little bit of a financial crisis. In fact, they just recalculated the data a couple of weeks ago, and they shortened that sunset by a year, and for one of the programs by 2 years. So the day of reckoning is coming. And the question is going to be whether or not we are going to have the political will, whether we have enough credible leaders in D.C. that they're going to develop a template that is going to be imposed upon all of these states, right, as to how they deal with the federal dollars that they are given, so that we can expand, we can try to impact, gain the greatest impact by that federal spend. What the state does with their state dollars is of no moment to any other state. What additional benefits they want to give on top of that program needs to come in a different program. We don't want to commingle the dollars because we want to be able to follow through on the audit of that federal spend. There's no big secret here, folks. This is not a conspiracy. This is dollars in, dollars out. What can the country afford? You know, how much would it require in tax increases to be able to continue to do these things? You know, I got another text. It's not just California. I know that, but he obviously is from that area of the country, meaning my guest, Harry Nelson. He knows that system, so we use them as an example of how this thing is getting out of hand. And the greatest example of this, not to beat up on California, they decided to allow illegals to benefit from the state Medicaid system, not really knowing and not doing their homework in order to determine what the actuarial impact was going to be on the program. Then they started to see the numbers come in, and they fast realize we can't afford this. Yeah, that we may have a desire to be all things to all people, but we can't afford it. So what did they do? They started limiting it. And there's now a sunset, I think, in 2027 or 28. So they're starting to wean off by demographics of that. In other states, they just cut it off because they realize they don't have the money. And the only way they could get the money is to propose tax increases. Now, if that's where you are, you're in the minority. But that's what it's going to take. That's the day of reckoning. That's when the math has no emotion and tough decisions need to be made. No one's arguing the need or the desire to have a Medicaid program. What the debate is about is how many items are going to be on the menu and how much is the spend? And can we as individual states afford it? And can the federal government afford it? Plain and simple. We'll be right back. Folks, when we return, we'll visit with Jay LaPere, CEO of Latrim, board chair of the Cato Institute and the Atlas Society.